So my headlanter today is Rachna Singh, whose journey spans academia, finance, and creative writing. Her academic foundation was rooted in literature, where she earned accolades, including gold medals for academic excellence in English literature, and was honored with the prestigious Nehru Centenary Scholarship for a doctorate at the University of Cambridge. However, Rachna's path took an unexpected turn, and she ventured into the Indian Revenue Service in the realms of finance, taxation, economics, and law. Despite this professional shift, her passion for writing remained steadfast. In September 2021, Rachna transitioned full-time into writing. She founded The Wise Owl, an online literary and art magazine, a pivotal step in her journey towards artistic fulfillment. Her latest work, Phoenix in Flames, pays homage to resilience of ordinary women, where she unveils tales of fortitude and determination. As an aside, Rachna is the elder sister of my childhood friend Puneet. Despite spending many hours at their home, I never realized there was so much more to discover about her, perhaps due to her self-proclaimed introverted nature. Without further ado, let's delve into Rachna's awe-inspiring journey. Hi, Rachna. Very warm welcome to Atlanta Diaries.
Thank you, Enma, for inviting me to share my journey on Atlanta Diaries. And Atlanta Diaries is all about strong, resilient women, a subject which is very close to my heart. So it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
Awesome. You know, I read some of your early works and I enjoyed reading The Rum Guzzlers. Share with us, how did your early years shape your journey?
Yeah, so I had a wonderful childhood in the lap of nature. Proximity to nature taught me a lot of things, and those skills helped me later in life. I was probably 3.5 years old when I had my first exposure to birds and animals. A milkman, he brought a small little dove who had injured her wing to my father, and I helped my dad to put ointment on the wing and feed the little dove. And when she recovered, my dad said, now we have to let her go back. I wasn't very happy about that, because as a child, I wanted to kind of hold on to something that I liked and loved. But he insisted. So, of course, we let her off. But she would come back every day. She would sit on the ledge outside the kitchen and she would let me gently stroke her head. So that was the start of my love for birds and animals. And then I remember another time when my dad was posted in Bharatpur. This is a place in Rajasthan. And there was a forest fire and a Nilgai calf was separated from its herd. So the soldiers got hold of that Nilgai calf and brought it to my dad. And on me fell the task of, you know, feeding her with a bottle and making sure she's okay. So I would rush back from school wanting to go and say hello to her. And eventually, of course, she recovered. And as usual, my dad said, now she should go back to her herd. So we went to the edge of the forest and we let her out. And the herd, of course, was there waiting for her. They embraced her literally, you know, and they took her away. And I would be sitting there moping around thinking of her. My dad would sometimes take me to the edge of the forest, you know. And once, actually, there was a herd of Nilgai which came back. And I think one of them was her. I used to call her Nilu. And because she sort of, although a little timorously, she came towards me. And when I put out my hand, had a couple of leaves in my hand, she took it from my hand and then she left. So I was lucky to be so close to nature, because my dad was in the army and he was posted to all kinds of far-flung, you know, never heard of places, which were mostly surrounded by forest. And I think these encounters were a part of my life, you know, they were my friends. And they taught me to be compassionate and sensitive. And of course, when I started writing, I started writing about them. In fact, my first middle that I wrote for a national daily was about rum guzzlers, which you read. And then there was another one called The Childhood Coterie, which talks about my friendship with Neelu, the Neel guy. So that's the way my early growing years sort of walked into my writings.
Awesome. And one really wonders, how did that pivot take place, you know, from a romantic novelist to an Indian Revenue Service officer? How did you take that tough decision?
Yeah, so my career path had quite a few twists and turns. As a child, probably inspired by my ministering to the various animals and birds, I thought I would be a doctor, you know, and I planned to be a doctor. And I took up science as a stream. But when I was in my 12th, I remember the school took us to this local medical college where I saw the chloroformed corpse of a beggar. And then that gave me pause. I wondered if I wanted to, you know, tread this path and whether I would be able to bring anything to the table, so to speak, as a doctor. And I switched gears and I went on to do my honors in English literature. And then after that, when I was doing my MPhil in English literature, my uncle felt that I was probably not tapping my potential by just doing literature, because he felt that I perhaps did not have much of a future other than being a lecturer or a professor of literature in college. So he would get after me and tell me that, why don't you apply for civil services? I sort of nodded because I respected him, but I was not particularly interested at that point in time. But he insisted, so sort of to get him off my back, I told him that, yeah, I will prepare for the civil services. I'll give my exam. But the first time, I didn't give the exam at all. And after the preliminary results came out, that was in 1990, my uncle called me up and he says, what was your result? And I was a little shamefaced. I told him, I'm sorry, I didn't even give the exam. Now, he was absolutely livid. And he just withdrew.
Wow.
And that was a bit of a shock for me because I respected him so much. He was like my creative mentor. And I actually started working for the exam. So in 1990, June, I gave my preliminary exams. And as luck would have it, I cleared my prelims and the mains and the interview. It's a 1-year process. And I then joined the civil services.
Yeah, very interesting. We are all born in that era or generation where, you know, what elders told us meant a lot.
Yeah.
Do you think something like this would have any relevance in today's era, the way your creative mentor guided you?
Probably not. I think probably it would have pushed them in the wrong direction. But in my case, what happened was that my parents were of a different ilk altogether. My parents were very encouraging. They did not interfere with my decisions. And sometimes I feel probably they should have pushed me to become a doctor. But when I said I didn't want to become a doctor, they were okay with it. So they never, ever, my dad or my mom, they never pushed me to do anything. And I mean, today I can look back and say that the decisions that were taken were my own decisions. And if I was unhappy with the decisions, then it was my problem. And they also taught me to be friends with your children. So with my mother, she was like a confidant for me. She was like a friend for me throughout life. So I think I took on my parenting style from my parents. Although I was definitely much more firm than my parents were ever with me, but I did not really push them. As far as my son was concerned, he always wanted to be a software engineer, so it was okay. I didn't say anything. I just sort of facilitated the entire process. With my daughter, she had a bit of a dilemma. She was good in her studies, but she was also playing competitive golf. So initially, she was of a mind that she wanted to maybe do art so that she could, you know, balance it with her golfing. But there I did put my foot down. I did tell her, you ought to pick up a career which will at least make you financially independent. Because I feel that for women, financial independence is a must. Because that gives them freedom, actually, to do whatever they want. So with my daughter, I insisted that she should pick up maybe engineering or architecture. And so she opted for engineering as well. But yes, she did need to give up her golf because of that. But again, that was her decision, not mine. So I hope I've been a good parent. I hope I've not interfered with their decisions. So that's my story as a parent, as a mom.
Interesting. And when you fit to reflect on that same conversation again about your creative mentor, what would you think about it?
Well, he felt that my potential was probably not going to be tapped by just being a lecturer. And maybe he was right. So probably he read me better than I did myself, because he had also seen me writing. He was the one who encouraged me to write. I would scribble, you know, in my journal, or you know, write bits and read them out to my family and all that. But he wanted me to go beyond that comfort zone I was like sitting in, because I was an introvert. I didn't want to be very visible. So in retrospect, I think, yes, the push that he gave me was in the right direction.
So from literature to taxation and finance must have been quite a journey. So talk to us. How did you earn that seat at the table and become the successful IRS officer?
Yeah, it was pretty tough. But the only thing in my favor was the fact that I, to start with, had been a STEM student. So it was not as though numbers were something new to me. So it did take me a bit of time to grasp the nuances of taxation. And also, we needed to know a lot about the legal system. But we are given training in our parent academy. First 3 months, we have a common training irrespective of the service that we are joining. And then the last 15 months, we are sent to our parent academy, where we are trained in the job that we are supposed to deliver once we leave the academy. So we had to give exams, and we had to pass those exams, or if not, we had to do a repeat of those exams. So after that, obviously, I felt more prepared to handle what I was supposed to do. And by then, I had become used to handling accounts and handling profit and loss accounts, income tax issues. So it was not as difficult as I thought it would be.
Your work ethic probably allowed you to, I think, slip into it seamlessly.
Yeah, right from the beginning, I was very tenacious, if nothing else. I don't know if that is a compliment or not.
In fact, since you talked about tenacity, what factors do you think attribute to your success thus far? You know, gold medal in Masters and MPhil, the Nehru Centenary Scholarship, which you unfortunately had to give up.
Well, I would say literature was always my first love. So when I was studying literature during my master's or my MPhil, I enjoyed doing it so much that it didn't appear to be like a task for me, you know. I would keep studying while my peer group would crib about the books they had to read through or the research material they had to read through. I would do it for a lark, you know. I enjoyed doing it. The story about the Nehru Centenary Scholarship has a slight twist, in the sense that I remember a senior of mine had gone to Cambridge University to do her doctorate. I was pretty keen to do it as well. But then when I started checking around, I found that the fee would be pretty steep. So I sort of gave up on that idea. But then one of my professors in the university, he told me that there is this Nehru Centenary Scholarship, which was the 100th year of Jawaharlal Nehru. So the government had instituted that scholarship. And he said, why don't I apply for it? And if I get it, then they would sponsor my studies. So I did. And I was awarded that Nehru Centenary Scholarship. But the irony of it was that I had cleared the civil services and I had joined the National Police Academy, where we were supposed to report. And I was already there for almost a fortnight when I received a letter from my dad saying that I had been accepted, you know, by the Cambridge University. So the typical Hamletian dilemma, to be or not to be kind of a dilemma, was there. And then I felt that I would prefer to stay in my country instead of going out. And I would maybe, as a civil servant, be able to do something for the country, give back to the society what society had given me. So because of that kind of a sense of idealism, I stayed on in India. And so here I am still.
How lovely. And I want to double click on this idealism, and the romantic Rachna who wrote so beautifully thought the world was utopic, right? So from there, the journey to becoming a civil services officer, I'm sure must have opened your eyes to the real world.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I was probably too idealistic, too utopian, and my parents were also actually pretty idealistic now that I think of. Mama also, I remember she would think that the world works on a divine plan and everything is fair and right and just in the world, which obviously is not. So when you are faced with things that make you a little skeptical about this belief that everything is good, you do evolve as a person, you grow up as a person. But fortunately, they did not make me skeptical or cynical about the system. I remember when I joined the field, my first posting was as Assistant Commissioner Income Tax in Jalandhar. I was an assessing officer and I had a certain jurisdiction. And so people from that area were my income tax assessees. So we evaluate their income and we pass assessment orders. Because of that, I had sent out a notice to a person. It had been brought to my notice was a tax evader. He was a man who was into rubber chappal business. And instead of this prosperous businessman, looked like he was completely impoverished. He wore soiled clothes and he had a woebegone face and he looked pretty harassed. And he folded his hands and he told me that life had, dealt him a tough blow and that he didn't have any money to pay taxes. I was taken in. I was a little naive when I had initially joined. And I thought, what I'm seeing is the real stuff. So he left and I told him, I said, okay, I would do whatever best I could for him. And then I called my inspector and I told him that looks like this seems to be a wrong complaint. Because that guy also told me that this has been done out of some kind of familial vendetta. So somebody has filed a wrong complaint against him. So my inspector smiled and he must have been thinking in his mind that these naive officers, they don't know anything about real life. And he told me, he said, ma'am, just come out into the balcony and tell me what you see. I walked out into the balcony and there I saw this man who had been in my office and he'd come limping in. And suddenly he was walking erect and he was walking out into the parking lot. And there was one Contessa Park at that time. Contessa was a bit of a status symbol. And there was a driver, livery driver there. And he opened the door and this gentleman got in and they drove off. And so my inspector said that, ma'am, he's a very, very prosperous businessman and he believes in evading taxes. He has a lot of black money and he was just trying to fool you into believing that he is down and out. And I realized that it was correct. And so after that, I became a little more, shall I say, careful about my assessment of people around me. And I would make sure to, do my research, check out the background, do a recce if need be, to assess and evaluate if what the person was telling me was actually the truth or just a story or a yarn that he was, making up. So that was my first, introduction to the big bad world. But you learn the ropes slowly and steadily. And I learned. And then by the end of 30 years, I was one of those very firm, very stern officers who could not be, taken in this fashion.
Yeah. But I'm also wondering, I think even to earn the respect in your team, probably it was important that you even take them seriously.
Yeah. Because, and you learn very quickly because as a junior officer, you are thrown into a whole lot of situations. You go for searches. They require a lady officer on the residential premises in searches. Then, whether you are a woman or you are a man, or whether you are naive or you are pragmatic, you have to do the surveys, you have to go to the industrial area, and obviously, you have to meet the targets. There are a whole lot of parameters that used to evaluate your performance for the entire year. which means what assessments you are doing, what are the kind of additions you are making, what is the kind of tax evasion that you have managed to find. All of those things are used to evaluate your performance. So you can't become shrinking Lily and say, oh, the world is very good and I'm not going to be taking it on. And, you know, many times, especially being a lady officer, meant that some people would try to intimidate you. I remember we did a search on a real estate guy in Gurgaon, and I was at the residential premises, and that man tried to intimidate me physically by telling me how, when the last income tax team had been there, they had shut them in a room, and how he had set his dogs on them.
Oh my
God. So they, yeah, yes. But then you learn and you become strong and you know you can handle it. And once you cope with it, once you handle it, you know you can do it all. Otherwise, you don't earn respect. For a woman, I don't know about other career sectors, but in our service also, what you need to do is you need to earn the respect. And for that, you need to be good at your work. And since I was very ambitious and always very focused on excelling, so I guess I tried to do the same here.
Very interesting. So, you know, whenever I would coach my clients, and especially the ones who were women, I think the challenge came when they moved into this leadership position. And those are the typical challenges they would talk about. How do I earn my seat at the table? How do I influence decision? They would say, men have to simply state and women have to convince. Any anecdotes or any experiences when you encountered the same feeling?
Yeah. Luckily, I didn't really face this issue, neither from my peers, nor from my junior officers, nor from my senior officers. They didn't expect me to go out and prove my mettle. Their approach was that if I'm an officer working with them, then I would be doing what they were doing, which I was doing. I mean, so if they were reporting for search duty at 4 o'clock in the morning, I was also reporting for duty at 4 o'clock in the morning. If we were going for surveys and we were at, you know, industrial premises till 12 o'clock at night, counting stock, I was doing the same thing along with them. Where I faced this kind of gender bias was when the legal fraternity would come to my office to present their cases. See, because as an assessing officer or even as a commissioner income tax appeals, you are a quasi-judicial court, which means that they come to your room, they treat you as a quasi-judicial authority, they present their case, I ask them questions and all of that. So here I would often see that a lot of the advocates and also the chartered accountants would sound very patronizing at that time. They would sound as though I would not be able to grasp the basic nuances of income tax or finance or law. So I was initially pretty upset about this kind of behavior, but slowly you get used to it and you know how to handle it. So the point is not to really confront them on this issue. The point is just to prove that you are good enough, which is what I would do. If you have your facts right, you know your law, income tax law, you know your rules, you know what sections you are working with, and you know the nuances of all those sections, then after a while, everybody realizes that you know your job and you are not going to be treated in this patronizing fashion. And yes, it happened with me initially, but slowly they realize what you are and they accept you for what you are.
Since you understood these problems, were you able to mentor other officers who came after you so that they did not have to go through these challenges?
See, we have probationary officers who are then sent to whatever charge you're holding at that time. And we are supposed to mentor them in the various nuances of income tax, how to practically implement the rules and the laws. When these officers would come to me, and a lot of the time there were only male officers, sometimes there were women officers, it all depended. I don't think I really saw that kind of a gender bias in them, But I tried always to build an awareness of the equality between men and women. And probably I think I succeeded because I haven't, like I said before, within the service, I haven't seen that kind of a gender bias. In fact, a lot of my colleagues in Delhi, the women officers, are so strong that they would any day outrun and outsurpass their male colleagues.
I love that.
In presenting their part of the story or in convincing them how things are to be done.
Shifting gears a little bit, you face some pivotal moments, including the sudden loss of, I want to say, auntie, and you were also caregiving after that. Alongside a demanding career, you had to sometimes stay away from the family. Don't sound like easy times at all. But these are also realities which I think others can learn from. So share with us, how did you navigate through these really complex and challenging times?
Yeah, as a junior officer, see, spouses are posted together. So me and my husband, we were mostly posted together in our initial 12 or 13 years of service. That was the good part in the sense that we can balance and sort of divide up the family responsibilities because children were very young at that time. But the focus at that time was on our careers because that was a time when we were still learning and still growing. Later, as we became more senior, we were posted in different places. So for almost 13 years, we were posted in different places. Harmeet was posted somewhere, I was posted somewhere. And there was a point when my son, he was studying in Hyderabad. My daughter, Kainat, she was studying in Chandigarh.
Wow.
I was posted in Delhi. Harmeet was posted in Jaipur. The family was, you know, broken apart, sort of. So it was very difficult to get everybody together. In fact, I wrote a very ironical kind of an article on that also, which was about the geography of marriage, it was called. And it dwelt upon this kind of a problem that is very typical in government services, especially when both husband and wife are in the same service. And then in 2008, suddenly out of the blue, Mama was diagnosed with cancer. And the sad part was that we didn't even have time to come to grips with the reality of her illness. One day she was diagnosed and within 3 months she was gone. And the tough part was that we were not at all prepared for her going away. For me, she was, like I said before, she was like a confidant and friend. And there were lots of things I never discussed with others, you know, even with my friends. But she was the one I would discuss everything under the sun with. And when she went away, it was like a sudden vacuum, you know. I suddenly felt completely lost. I had lost one of the major anchors in my life. And I didn't know what to do with myself. And I guess it was natural. I started moping. I started internalizing. I was an introvert. I didn't share my grief with anybody. I thought I was supposed to be a strong woman. I am a strong woman. So how could I sort of unburden myself on other people? It was not the done thing. And so I didn't really cry before anybody. I didn't talk about it with my children. I didn't want to cry before them because they were young and I didn't want my grief to sort of spill over into their lives. And I started having these bouts of severe anxiety and depression. I didn't even realize what was happening, you know. Suddenly, I would have this strong, you know, heart rate would suddenly go up, tachycardia, it was called. And I thought maybe there's some cardiac problem, went to the doc, and the doc said, no, it is not that. It is anxiety due to the trauma that you have gone through and also depression. So he gave me some antidepressants and also he prescribed some sedatives and anti-anxiety pills. But my husband and my mother-in-law, who are both doctors, they were adamant that I should not take those antidepressants, which meant that I had to make an effort to get out of it. Now, thankfully, my mother-in-law was a real darling. She realized I had lost a mother She tried to replace that. She shut her house down for almost a year, came and stayed with me. Harmeet, my husband, was posted outside. And I remember going to the senior officer, requesting them to post him back here in Chandigarh, but they refused. And so I felt very alone with my children. I didn't want to share with my dad because already he was a patient of Parkinsonism and already he was suffering the biggest loss possible, you know, and losing a companion. I mean, that loss is nothing as compared to a loss of a mother. Losing a companion is the worst thing that can happen to anybody. So I thought he had enough on his plate. I didn't want to bother him with all that. I was in a very, very bad place. And typically, my friends, my family, they all assumed that because I was an officer, I would be strong. And because I didn't go crying to them, they assumed that I was managing just fine. They didn't realize that I was having a breakdown. I would get a lot of positive input from my mother-in-law, from the children, and of course, from my sister, Neetu. She would keep calling every day and sort of try to make me feel better about things. And then something very strange happened, which suddenly made me realize that I needed to pull up my boots. Nobody's going to be helping me to get out of it. One day, suddenly I realized that my daughter had been in the bathroom for almost 45 minutes. And I also realized that it was dark and she hadn't turned out the light. I got worried. I banged on the door and she came out. And I asked her, I said, "What were you doing inside there with the light switched off?" And she said that, "You know, I'm scared of the dark, Mama. And so I need to get over it." And so I decided that I'm going to sit in the bathroom in pitch dark till I learn how to cope with it. I'm not coming out of there. And that was like the sort of light at the end of the tunnel. She was probably 10 or 11 at that time. And I thought to myself that if she can do it, why can't I do it? I need to get out of this, you know, nightmare that I've sort of put myself into. I have to get out of it. Otherwise, life would just, you know, go on in this fashion and I would probably end up having to take medicine for my problem. And it also reminded me of, I don't know if you've read Paradise by Milton, you know, he says, the mind is its own place and can make a hell of heaven and a heaven of hell. So I decided that I had to make heaven out of my hell. Now, obviously, it's easier said than done. But then I decided I first needed to switch from this complete focus on myself and moping about it and feeling bad about what the kind of blow that destiny had hurled at me. My daughter at that time was playing competitive golf. And so I decided I would now focus on it. I would go with her, to the trainer. I would go with her to the coach. I would walk the course with her. I started traveling with her when she was playing tournaments to other cities. And then I also started meeting a lot of young golfers, young girls. And I would see that if they played a bad round of golf, they would, you know, practice late into the night. And next day they would go out and play and they would come off with a wonderful round of golf. You know, I realized that I needed this kind of inspiration and young children working the way they were really inspired me. And I also started meeting other people. So I started going out and I also went back to my writing in a big way. For the last 4 or 5 years, I had stopped writing completely. And I also picked up music. Classical vocal music I used to enjoy doing as a young girl. And so I went back to music and I went back to piano and all of that. So all of these things put together, they sort of gave me a perspective about life. And I'm so thankful for that little lesson I learned from my daughter out of the mouth of babes, as they say. And this is completely true. And she made me suddenly see what I was doing wrong and how I needed to get out of it.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's the way I navigated the biggest tragedy, the biggest hurdle in my life till now.
Yeah, thank you for sharing, Rachna. I'm getting goosebumps listening to you. I think the biggest takeaway is that we just have to take control. You just took control and look at the circle of life, that how suddenly we find mentors in our own kids. We are first, we are nurturing them to grow up, and then they become our mentors, and we
And
learn.
suddenly they are those wise old men and women, you know, who are giving us life
So
lessons.
true, so true.
Yeah.
And then you took this courageous step of shifting from civil services to becoming a full-time writer. A huge leap, I think. So what really inspired you to take that plunge? Because like you said, early on, women have to be financially independent. And early on, your creative mentor recognized that not necessarily it's the most financially gainful profession in a sense, right? So I know I've asked you a lot of questions in this one statement.
So like I said before, writing was always my first love. Let me not say writing. Let me say reading was my first love. And transitioning from reading to writing was like a spontaneous thing that happened. And of course, like I said, I was writing for the National Dailies. I also did a financial column for a National Daily. And then when I was in the services, I was learning a lot about finances and taxation nuances and all of that. So I thought maybe I should meld together my literary inclinations and my financial learning. So I put all of that together and I came up with three books on financial issues. My first book was Penny Panache, and it was all about contemporary economic issues. The thing is that economics and finance, that most people don't even want to touch it with a barge pole, you know? It's like,
so true.
There's such a mystique around it. So I wanted to demystify these financial issues, because even I had gone through that kind of journey. So my books were basically aimed at demystifying finance for the common man who's not tutored in finance. But I also realized I did these when I was still in the services. I wrote these books in that span from 2016 to 2021. But I realized that I could only do so much and not more as far as writing was concerned, because obviously the majority of my time was taken by my day job and I could not afford to make it second priority. So I realized that if I needed to write full time and during the corona period in 2021, the only term I can say is my muse was like desperately beckoning. I wanted to start writing full time. So then I decided that I would have to, you know, make a choice. I quit my job as a civil servant. I took voluntary retirement and I started writing full time. But when you are a writer, what happens is there are some days that you're inspired to write and there are some blocks of days when you're not particularly interested in writing. I needed something else to hold me aloft. When I was writing and I was trying to publish my books, I realized that it is a real obstacle path to get your work published.
Sure.
At times, they expect payment from you. At times, you need to have networking, not simply merit, to get your work or your piece in a magazine or a journal or a daily. So I wanted to nurture literature. And I wanted to also make the path, you know, easier for upcoming writers and poets. So I decided on starting this literary and art magazine called The Wise Owl, online magazine, which would nurture literature and art and which would feature and showcase poetry and stories and creative nonfiction pieces and all of that. And the bonus that I didn't expect out of this entire venture, the bonus for me personally, was that during the course of my interviews with a lot of big writers, I connected for an interview with Daisy Rockwell, who won the International Booker Prize. This time we connected with Paul Lynch, who won the Booker Prize 2023. And I would gain an insight into their creative process and their writing, how they were honing their skills, how they were honing their craft. So in that kind of atmosphere of literary activity, you know, that really inspired me also to write. Phoenix and Flames, which is my first completely fiction book, was a result of my connecting with these creative giants and creative wizards. I mean, even to connect with them was like the mecca of literature kind of thing, you know, that kind of feeling you get. Initially, I used to be very nervous and apprehensive about talking to them. I thought maybe these big geniuses and how would I connect? But when you talk to them, you suddenly realize that they are also normal human beings with normal foibles, normal problems, normal pain, grief, all of the typical human problems that we are all beset with. And that really inspired me.
Then what I'm hearing is that all of us go through these strange, I don't know, insecurities or under maybe lack of confidence or whatever at every level. Like I'm talking to an Atlanta who's been a 30-year civil services officer, yet she's getting inspired.
Self-doubt is, I think, very natural to everybody. And I remember when I was talking to Paul Lynch last time, imagine he is the author of so many award-winning novels and now he wins the Booker Prize. And I was asking him how he became a novelist. And he said that was something I did not want to become. And I tried not to become it. I tried being a journalist and I tried being a film reviewer. But finally, he said it called me and I had to go back to it. And he also said that we need to fight our self-doubts and overcome those self-doubts and, you know, focus on doing what we want to do. And I don't know if you know of Raghu Rai. He's supposed to be the father of Indian photography. He's almost 80 now. His journey also inspired me a lot. I interviewed him last year also. And his passion and dedication for his craft inspired me. And what really was a life lesson for me was when he told me that for me, it's an ongoing quest. I'm still trying to take photographs that are better than the last ones that I've taken, you know. And that I thought was very inspiring. We are going to be trying to better ourselves all the time. And that is what life is all about.
Yeah.
It's almost like a spiritual quest. And
I did notice that Phoenix and Flames is like a departure from your earlier works, right? So what inspired you to get into that narrative?
These were stories that probably were with me for a very long time. These are stories about women from different walks of life, women who face different tragedies in life, but they are united in their grief, in their anguish. But most importantly, they're united in their ability to rise out of that grief and anguish like the mythical phoenix. And these women are all imaginary characters in my book. You know, Malini, Seher, Sana, there are 8 women protagonists in my book. And it would be probably correct to just say that they are inspired by real life and they're imaginary characters. But to be very honest, I did come across these women over the last 30, 40 years. I have come across these women and women like these, you know. So the narrative is not replicating their story, but it is replicating the essence of what they have gone through. So for some reason, they confided in me, talked about their pain and suffering, and I didn't want to break that trust really. So I thought that if I just placed the essence of their pain in the narrative without replicating the actual life and the actual facts of life, perhaps I would be able to communicate the message that I wanted to communicate through this book, which is that even ordinary women have the ability to fight their tragedies and adversities and emerge victorious in the end. So when I first decided to go to fiction full time and I started to write, these stories sort of surfaced and spontaneously when I was tapping on my laptop, the keys, these were the stories that I started spontaneously writing.
This is beautiful. It's almost like I'm hearing 8 Atlantas from one more Atlanta, you know. So I
Yes, it is like a very, very, very similar to that.
Yeah.
Because Phoenix is a bird in Egyptian mythology, and they say it lives for 500 years. And they say after 500 years, it self-immolates. And from the ashes emerges a brand new phoenix. So, because these women characters go through the pain and anguish of life, and then they emerge in a new avatar, you know? So, I thought that Phoenix in Flames would be a good title for my book because it sort of alludes to their pain and it's a metaphor for emergence, for their rejuvenation, call it what you will, survival, you know, rebirth, whatever.
This has been so lovely. And before we end the conversation, I can't help but donning my coaching hat and asking you one difficult question. Feel free not to answer. Given that you're a self-proclaimed somewhat introvert, and as a writer, you know, I think at some level, again, I draw another parallel that when we bring out such beautiful content, whether it's in the form of a podcast or a book, I think in your case, a book building readership,
Yeah,
you don't have a
absolutely,
choice but to put
absolutely.
yourself out there, right? So my question is, how do you want to put yourself out there so that there's a balance in the need for visibility, yet you retain your authentic introverted nature?
See, you're right. I am an introvert, and given a choice, I would just sit in my room, read a book, not meet people, not go out. I still get stage fright if I have to go up and promote my book. I'm being very honest with you. But the thing is that if you have to grow and evolve as a person, you need to confront your fears. You need to do things that are outside your comfort zone. Because if what you are doing demands you to be more visible, then so be it. So I sort of told myself that it's okay. Now I'm writing. This is what a writer needs to do. So I can do it and I will do it. Why not? So I just go ahead and do it. Initially, you feel apprehensive, but see, there are a lot of nice people out there, people who are very sweet in their interactions, very encouraging about your growth and maybe your initial baby steps. But I believe that if something needs to be done, it needs to be done. So I'm simply doing it. And perhaps at some point in time, I'm going to start enjoying it, maybe liking the, you know, whatever, the importance or visibility of it all. But for the moment, it's a little new to me. So my steps are a little timorous, not maybe very confident, but I hope to reach that also pretty soon.
I love it. Baby steps, one step at a time. Thank you very much, Rachna. I really enjoyed the conversation.
It was a pleasure to talk to you, Enma. Thank you so much for inviting me to share my journey. It was almost like a catharsis for me also.
Thank you for being a part of this incredible journey with Atlanta Diaries. I have had the privilege of hosting guests who courageously shared their most vulnerable selves with me. And even if only a small segment of these conversations can champion the journey of one person, it will be worth each and every moment. And together, we know we can create an even greater impact. So I do have a humble request for you. If you found value in these episodes, please consider sharing the podcast with your friends, family, and on your social media. I would also love to hear your thoughts and will really appreciate if you could take a moment to leave a review or rating. See you next week for another inspiring journey on Atlanta Diaries.